Well, this is the last regular lecture. I may have a short one, but this is the last regular one. And typically, I spend the last lecture talking about negotiations, the so-called peace process. But I don't think there is a peace process. It's a waste of our time. The Camp David peace process was used basically to thicken the settlements. So that made a settlement less likely. As I've said before, I think there really is there's going to be a peace process. If there's going to be peace, it has to involve withdrawal of the Israelis from the Palestinian territories. And they're doing the exact opposite. They're trying to gain control of more territories, including annexing what appears to be the whole of Area C on those maps, if you're paying attention to those maps, plus selected areas elsewhere. So the idea of a Palestinian state, it's dead. There'll never be a Palestinian state. The Israelis keep having these illusions that they can just leave some little pieces of territory here and there and create a puppet government, and maybe Jordan will take over. None of those things are going to happen. So what we have is a catastrophe in the making. That's what it looks to me like. The U.S. role, we always played a role, not because people misunderstand this. You know, we're acting on behalf of the Israelis and the Palestinians. No, we're not. We're acting on behalf of ourselves. And so if we don't keep focused on the American interest, what is our interest in this? I think our interest in this is to prevent the radicalization of Islam, because as long as the Israelis keep control of the holy sites in Jerusalem, this is inflammatory, and it's escalating tensions. The other thing is, we don't want to have the next war, whatever that is. It's going to be awful, and we're going to be entangled in it. So that's our interest in this. Forget caring about the Israelis and caring about the Palestinians, and oh, come on, please spare me. And that's what politicians say just to reassure people that they're virtuous, which they very often are not. And it's a shame. They're supposed to look out for our interest, not for someone else's interest. If helping someone else along the way is a good thing, then fine. But we have to keep our interest there. And at times you hear people talking as if they're actually looking after someone else's interest. That's not going to lead to a settlement. The whole idea of the Palestinian Authority as a governing entity that could be strengthened, oh, really? No, no, no. The Palestinian Authority is a shell. It's a few buildings with some government officials, some tax collectors, some teachers, some officials, some foreign payments, some bribery, a lot of stealing. It's not a viable organization. And Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, the president of Palestine, he's a really good person. But there's no way, given the structure of power, that he could have ever succeeded at anything. So I want you to read, if you haven't already, my talk that I delivered to on Land Day. This is a big day in the Palestinian community. And there's a talk that I have delivered multiple times, and I delivered it on Land Day. That was a day in when? 1976? When there were protests inside of Israel. I've forgotten which town. Maybe it was Nazareth. And I think 6 or 8 Palestinians were shot dead on that day. And so it's in April, and the Palestinians have commemorated it every year since. So there was a big event here in Livonia, and I was invited out, and so to be a keynote speaker. So I spoke to the group, and I outlined 4 options. Now, those 4 options were options that I had figured out when I taught my class on the politics of the developing areas, and I have a unit in that. A couple of you have had that class. I had a unit in that on ethnic conflict. And we looked at different countries where there had been conflicts and how they were solved. And so I came down with four possible outcomes for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, please read that carefully, because I'm going to just hit some high points here, but there's a lot of more points that are worth thinking about. Option number one is the continuation of the status quo. By that, I mean the Israelis occupy Palestinian land, claim it, settle it. And secondly, Israelis keep control over Palestinian lives. That's the status quo. It's not viable. Everybody agrees this is not viable. The status quo is not viable. What it means is that the Israeli population has to be pretty much on permanent alert. Large numbers of Israeli young people have to go on patrols every weekend, at least once a month, in the West Bank. You have to have a security state. You have to have a prison system. This is really not a viable situation. Look down the road 30, 40 years from now. Do you really think that's going to last? No, it won't. A second solution, some of the people in the audience the night that I spoke to that group on Land Day, it was a group of Palestinians. Some of them like this. They say, why don't we just create one state? Yasser Arafat was in favor of that. A democratic state for Muslims, Christians, and Jews. We'll have one state. Maybe we can have different regions federated together. Four or five different regions. Maybe the Galilee, where a majority of the population is Palestinian. Maybe that could be a zone. Maybe the coastal zone, which is overwhelmingly Jewish, that could be a zone. Maybe we could have this zone, the West Bank. Maybe we can have another zone. We can have all those zones. Okay, we'll be created, federated together. We'll have a common parliament. This is nice. I like this. We can adopt the American Constitution, actually. That's good. It works for them. Maybe we could have a Senate and a House of Representatives. That works for them. Why not do that? We'll have a Bill of Rights. We'll guarantee religious freedom. We'll have one state, and we can all work out our problems. Come on. For one thing, if I were an Israeli, I would fight that forever. If that were the option, I would say, okay, let's go for another round. There's no way this is going to happen. Nobody would agree to it. Whenever someone comes up with what sounds like a really, really wonderful proposal, you have to ask yourself, who's the partner? Who on the other side is going to sign the agreement? Nobody's going to sign that. Nobody, not a single person on the Israeli side would sign such an agreement to be united in one state with all the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Oh, come on. That's not going to happen. How many Palestinians would agree to that? I don't think so. Why would you want to be a part of a Jewish state? The first thing they're going to do is introduce a proposal to change it from a Jewish state to a secular state, a non-Jewish state. So there goes Zionism out the window. This is never going to work. So forget this. Now, the thing I always wanted for like two-thirds of my career as I taught this course was the idea of two states. I always thought that was a possibility. And in the 90s, I got kind of excited because there were these negotiations and it seemed possible they might actually produce something. I mean, there were some very creative negotiations. Those negotiations did not fail. They were very successful because they were moving towards what needed to be done. Now, what would have been that proposal? Well, it's basically what the Arab League has proposed, that there be two states based on the 1967 border, that Jerusalem be somehow, you'll have a Jewish side and a Palestinian side, and maybe the holy sites could be governed by a consortium, a council made up of Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Maybe you could bring someone from Sweden or Finland or somewhere to be the chair of that so you didn't have fighting. Maybe there would be vetoes on changes. We'll have a status quo agreement. We'll agree that everybody's got their own little piece of property, and nobody's going to mess with anybody else's property. And if we change this, this is the way they do it in Northern Ireland, right? They've got a constitution, and it provides all sorts of rights. And if anybody wants to change any of those key provisions, it has to be approved by the British Parliament, the Irish Parliament, and the Northern Ireland Parliament. Everybody's got to approve it, or you can't change it. Well, that's pretty logical if you're trying to protect people's rights. I thought that was possible. That's the version of, that's the position of the Catholic Church, by the way. Well, the position of the Catholic Church is that Jerusalem should be a corpus separatum. We've talked about that, haven't we? Corpus separatum. It should be an international entity governed by an international council. So no religious group will claim it. Well, that kind of makes sense to me. That's what I had hoped. No, hopeless. Hopeless. Now the Israelis have occupied so much of the West Bank, it's irreversible. And I'll tell you, we Americans know from our own history the settlers are really nasty. Look what happened to the Cherokees. The American government worked out an agreement with the Cherokees and said, okay, this land is yours. It's a treaty. It's a perpetual treaty. It's forever and ever. And then what happened? White settlers would go into that land. The Cherokees would drive them out. Somebody would get killed. Then the American army would go in to protect the white settlers. Okay, that's not going to work. The fourth solution is expulsion. Let's just kick the Palestinians out. Let's just kick the Jews out. Why don't the Jews go back to where they came from? Well, let them go to America. I talked to a Hamas leader once, and I said to him, we were in Jordan, and I said, okay, tell me. Well, what do you think is going to happen to the Jews when you have an Islamic state? He says, they'll take their money and they'll go to America. Well, that's kind of a fantasy. Some will, probably. But some will, even without an Islamic state. But that's not going to happen. And what about the Palestinians? Well, come on, there's 23 different countries. Let them go somewhere else. Let them be absorbed into those other countries. That's not going to happen. They don't want to be absorbed. They want to be Palestinians. They have a land. They're not going to give it up. So, wait a minute. I've just outlined four options. And I've just told you that not a single one of them is viable. So if nothing is viable, come on, we know that history doesn't give a darn for what we think. We can use all the logic we want. You and I, we can just sit here and we can come up with logical models and we can say, okay, none of these are going to work. Okay, I guess, I don't know, we're kind of in an impasse. Well, history doesn't like impasses. Things happen. History doesn't care what we think. So there's a man named Ian Lustig. He's one of my favorite political scientists. He's at the University of Pennsylvania. And he studied ethnic minority regimes. He studied South Africa, he studied Ireland, and Israel-Palestine. Those are the three that he's written books. He's really an impressive person. And he says there's something interesting when you look at these regimes. You look at these, he says, if you look around the world, you'll see something strange. That there are times when regimes just collapse. Nobody thought they were going to collapse. They just collapsed. Look at the Soviet Union. I can tell you, you're going to have to believe me, but I can tell you, we just woke up one morning and the Soviet Union wasn't there anymore. We say, whoa, wait a minute, what happened? Well, Russia voted to secede from the Soviet Union, and when Russia seceded from the Soviet Union, I don't know, there's not much left. Gorbachev was in charge of a country that really didn't exist. What about East Germany? I remember that very well. I was in Kenya. The University of Michigan Alumni Association asked me to lead a group of alums to Kenya because I'd lived there and I knew the place. And we had gone out in the morning to listen, to watch game, get up at 5:30 or so, go out for several hours, come back. I came back, my wife and I did. we went and ate our lunch, and then we went back to our rendezvous, our hut, and we were getting ready to take a nap, which is what you do, and then you go out in the afternoon for another tour of animals. And I turned on the BBC. I had brought my portable radio with me. And I turned on the BBC to listen to the news, and it said, the wall is down, people are dancing on the wall, everybody's cheering, the guards have thrown down their weapons, there's nobody stopping anything. It looks as if East Germany doesn't exist anymore. That was amazing. We never had the slightest idea this would ever happen. That was the meanest, nastiest regime in all of the Soviet bloc. Amazing. And it just disappeared. What about Yugoslavia? There was a state, and then suddenly one of the states said, we're declaring ourselves independent. And what happened? The Yugoslav army went in and crushed them, right? No, somebody else said, so are we. And suddenly, there was not a Yugoslavia anymore. It was gone, just like that. In South Africa, there was a white regime. They controlled everything. All the police, all the security, all the judges, all the professors, everything. Everyone who counted was white. And suddenly, they said, okay, we agree, we'll allow a majority election. Which meant that suddenly the whole political system was flipping from white to black. That just happened overnight. Nobody expected it. And Britain had held on to Ireland for how many years? I don't know. 400 years, something like that. And then suddenly in 1923, they said, okay. We'll let you have your independence. We're keeping this little stuff in the north, but you can have your independence. How did that happen? Britain wasn't defeated. They just suddenly thought, oh, it's over. France had controlled Algeria for 150 years. 10% of the population of Algeria were Europeans, were French. And at a certain point, France said, okay, we're putting it up for a vote. Do you want to continue being associated with us, like Canada is associated with Britain, or do you want total independence? And they voted overwhelmingly for total independence. And within a month, 90% of all those white people left and went back to France, of which 10%, by the way, were Jewish. They went back to France. This was 1962. And suddenly, the French control of Algeria was gone. History had reversed itself. Do you know what a black swan event is? Have you heard this term, black swan? It's a term used in economics. It's an unpredictable event that has severe consequences, and nobody predicted it, but when you look back, it's obvious that it was on its way. Our models, our predictive models, are based on certain assumptions, basically assumptions of stability that come from other countries and other cases. The example that people give in economics, for example, is the collapse of the banking system, the American banking system, in 2008. I mean, in retrospect, you could say those banks were engaging in such slimy junk bond dealings and selling derivatives and giving credit to people who had not the slightest chance of being able to pay off their loans. They were just making a pile of money, except it was all based on sand. All it took was just a little bit of a wave, and the castles disappeared. That was a black swan event. Suddenly, the banking system collapsed. And Shearson Lehman, one of the greatest banks, one of the biggest and most powerful banks in the whole country, just went out of existence, gone. Lustig says reality can shift. I'm still talking about Ian Lustig, remember? Ian Lustig says that reality can shift without us even realizing it. Think about the coronavirus. Suddenly, here we are. It's obvious in retrospect that there was a virus coming. I mean, Dr. Fauci said there's a virus coming. He said this 5 years ago. There's going to be a virus coming. We better be ready for it. They come, and we better be ready for it. In retrospect, people knew that it was coming. Was it the first week in January that the Chinese informed the World Health Organization that they had a dangerous virus that was loose in their country? Was that it? Was that only 3.5 months ago? And what happened? Nothing? Nobody did anything? Well, it's not here. That's Wuhan, China. That's not us. Okay, all of our models didn't work. Except in retrospect, you look back and say, wait, all the models did work. We weren't paying any attention. That's a black swan event. Suddenly something happens. There was a man named Nahum Goldman, N-A-H-U-M, Goldman. He was one of the, you know, in the 60s, he was one of the most prominent Zionist leaders. He was head of the World Zionist Organization and, you know, a really big shot guy. I really like Nahum Goldman. I've read some of his books and he's an interesting person. And once in a conversation, I didn't learn this until much later, once in a conversation, he said that Israel is an interlude. He said the Jews have been out of power for so long that they really don't know how to govern. And they've been so traumatized that they really can't make rational decisions. So Israel, it will be here for a while, 50 years, 100 years. He didn't know. He said it's going to be here for a while and then it's going to disappear simply because Jews don't know how to make rational decisions. Oh my goodness. Let's look at some realities. Let's look at some numbers. The EU, European Union, has a very generous policy on passports for Jews. It says that anybody whose parent or grandparent was a citizen of a European country can apply for a European passport. Now, in these days, you don't have to go back where your ancestors were. If your ancestors were, say, French, you don't have to go back to France. You can just get an EU passport. You can go to where? Germany? You can go to Italy? You can go to Spain? You can go anywhere you want. The Spanish themselves, feeling a bit bad that in 1492 they kicked out the Jews, have suddenly said, you know, if anybody can prove that they're actually descended from a Spanish Jew, i.e. a Sephardic Jew, we'll give you a citizenship. We'll give you a passport. The Germans are trying very hard to reseed their Jewish community. They basically have declared that anybody from the Soviet Union, any Jew from the Soviet Union who wants a German passport can come and live in Germany. It's actually working. They're building up the Jewish community again. It's quite amazing. 40% of all Israelis are eligible for an EU passport. Here's what I'm wondering. How many actually have an EU passport? Do we know? No, I don't think we do, but we can assume. If I were an Israeli, I would have an EU passport. I would say, oh, I can get an EU passport. I'm going to get one just in case. Anyway, if the economy falls apart here, I can go to Europe and get a job. And once I'm in Europe, I could probably go to the United States too because the Americans are nice to us. Many Israelis have American passports. They have a relative who's American or whatever. The Americans are very nice to the Israelis, letting them have passports. I don't have data for this, but there are a lot. There was a poll done in Israel which asked people, do you have a foreign passport? And of those who said yes, they do. I wish I knew how many said yes, they do. But of those who said yes, they do, 30% said they would consider leaving the country under certain circumstances. Wow. I read last year a story about an Israeli who was an American. He was born in the United States and he immigrated. Now, and he's an Israeli. And he's got a daughter and a teenage daughter. And he wrote a very moving essay. He said, you know, I like America. I lived there as a child. I could live there again, but I don't want to. I want to live in Israel. That's my home. That's where I'm going to stay forever. That's where I want to live. But he said, you never know the future. And he said, because I'm an American citizen, that means my daughter is eligible for American citizenship. So he said, last week, I took her to the American Embassy, and we filled out all the paperwork. And I showed my passport and my birth certificate and all those sorts of things. And so we processed the paperwork, and she now has an American passport. And he said, you know, I'm not thinking my daughter wants to go to America. She doesn't. She's happy to be an Israeli. But he said, you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking I didn't just get my daughter an American passport. I'm thinking that I saved my daughter's life, and I saved the lives of my future grandchildren, because this is not going to turn out well. I look at Israel and I think this is not going to turn out well. There was a poll on the 50th anniversary of Israel, and they asked Israelis, do you think Israel will be here in 50 years? Most of them said they were not sure. A majority of Israelis are not sure that Israel is going to make it to 100. There's real pessimism. So, I outlined four scenarios, and I said none of those are viable. But I also told you that history doesn't like things that are not viable. History doesn't like conflicts that just go on and on and on and on. Sooner or later, things are going to change. Sooner or later, something is going to happen. In Algeria, the inconceivable happened. And that a white population, which owned almost all the land and owned all the resources and lived exactly like a branch of Europe in Algiers and places like that, in 1 month, they were gone. 1 month. 90% of them left. They weren't driven out. This was before independence. France was still in control. But they just left. It was over. So what's going to happen? I don't know. But there's a black swan out there somewhere. Something is going to happen. Right now, Israel is militarily strong. They are so strong, they could defeat any combination of enemies. They sit around thinking, okay, we better start looking to the east because the Iranians are going to get nuclear weapons and they're going to bomb us. And over half of all the Israeli population lives in the greater Tel Aviv area. One nuclear bomb would cause us enormous damage. You know what I think? I think this is, if I were a strategic planner in Israel, I would keep an eye on Iran. But I tell you, that's not a threat. The Iranians are not stupid. If they dropped a bomb in Tel Aviv, the Israelis have probably 100 nuclear weapons. They would obliterate Iran. The Iranians know that. Now, what you will hear some people say is, oh, the Iranians are crazy. They want to bring about the arrival of the Mahdi, the Messiah. And if they can blow up Israel, that will bring the Messiah. And then everything will be peace and love, and they will have fulfilled their destiny. Come on, stop this racist gibberish. People say the same thing about evangelicals. They want to blow up the world so that the Christ will return. No, that's absolutely the opposite of what evangelicals teach. So what's the threat? If it's not Iran, it's not Iraq. They used to stay up at nights worrying about Iraq. Iraq doesn't exist anymore in any meaningful sense. They used to worry about Syria. Syria doesn't exist anymore in a meaningful sense. The Israeli military is really, really strong. They have all the best weapons. They could defeat any combination of enemies. If every Arab state attacked them, they would win. They're economically really strong, I tell you. There's a technology and that sort of thing. The Israelis are on top of that. Silicon Valley, I tell you, Tel Aviv's got all the. Tel Aviv would give Silicon Valley a run for its money. They're economically really, really strong. Militarily strong, economically strong. They have a really strong sense of tribal identity. I mean, Jews really do, the Israelis really do hang together. They hate each other, but when it comes to a conflict, they're going to all be in ranks, side by side, following generals that they may hate in the political system, but they're going to follow them militarily. Israel is a formidable force. What could possibly, I tell you, do you think I'm getting a little bit delusional talking about this black swan stuff? Do you think Ian Lustig is getting a little bit delusional talking about black swans? He doesn't talk about black swans, but he talks about suddenly things shift and we missed it. We didn't see it coming. We didn't realize that in 1 month, 90% of the French would leave Algeria. We didn't have the slightest idea that was going to happen. We didn't have the slightest idea the Soviet Union would just disappear, that the wall would fall in East Berlin. Nobody had the slightest idea. Things happen and our models don't predict it. You know why? Our models are incremental models. They're based on what we know, but there are things that we don't know. This is what Ian Lustig says. So what could happen? Well, the Israeli military thinks about this. Let's think about one thing that the Israeli military actually talks about. They actually talk about this. It's in their reports. It's what is called cesium-137. Cesium. It's a radioactive material. It's used in diagnostic equipment. It's in diagnostic devices in hospitals. It's very deadly. But what if somebody, there's the concept of the dirty bomb. Do you know what a dirty bomb is? Well, let's talk about what a dirty bomb is. You go to a construction site and you steal some dynamite, TNT, I don't know, whatever. You steal something that will blow up. That's pretty easy to do. And then you have someone go into a hospital and get some cesium-90. You can't take the whole piece of equipment with you, but you can break in and get the cesium-90 out and bring it with you. Now, it's going to kill you, of course. But if you're a suicide bomber, then you're going to die anyway. So the fact that you are walking out with cesium-90 in your pocket, that's not going to make the difference in the outcome. And then you put the cesium-90 inside the TNT and you stick it in a backpack or whatever you have. And you walk into downtown Tel Aviv and you blow yourself up. And you've radiated, what, let's say five square blocks of downtown Tel Aviv has been radiated. You can't go in there. It has to be evacuated. The people inside are now poisoned, so many of them are going to die. You have to evacuate downtown Tel Aviv for probably 5 months while you clean this out, bring in cleanup crews and clean this out. You know, the Israelis do earthquake drills. The Israeli military did an earthquake drill a couple years ago in Haifa. They said, okay, imagine that there's an earthquake. People say, well, wait a minute. What would you do if there's an earthquake? Where would you go? Well, I don't know. We never thought about it. We never have earthquakes there. Yeah, but we had one back in the mid-1800s. It was serious. And they might come around again. But we haven't had one for 150 years. Yeah, but you know, there's a cycle. Maybe they're going to come around again. We need to practice. Oh, come on. They're doing earthquake drills in places where there are no earthquakes. And then once they actually did a cesium drill, what if there was a dirty bomb that went off? They had emergency procedures, the cesium bomb test run. They had people all around the country, medical people, identified as emergency personnel, first responders. So you're in Jerusalem, and a bomb goes off in Tel Aviv. What are you going to do? Well, I get in my car and I drive over there and I park and I do this and I go to this spot and I'm in charge of this kind of thing. Okay. They did a dry run of a cesium attack. Okay, let's think about something. The Israeli military estimates that in the event of a serious attack of some kind, they're kind of vague about this, about exactly what it would be, but a serious attack, probably 50,000 Israelis would leave. Oh, come on. They're delusional. I think it would be closer to 500,000. Okay, let's think about this a minute. I don't have the slightest idea. I'm just guessing. If a cesium bomb went off in Detroit and killed thousands of people, and it was some terrorist group, and you lived in Livonia, would you think about moving? I think you might. Remember all those passports they have? Sure, EU passports, American passports, whatever passports. They have those. Okay, let's think about something. What if 500,000 Israelis left? Just, let's say within 2 months, 500,000 Israelis left. There's 8 million Israelis. That's the population. Probably 70% of those are Jews. So let's say there are 6 million Jews. We'll make that up. I don't have the figures in front of me. Let's say there are 6 million Jews. And 500,000 left. Who's going to leave? Well, the ones that have passports and the ones who can afford to leave. Who are the ones who can afford to leave? Well, the ones who have training, skills. Can you move your high-tech company to the Silicon Valley? Sure. If you're a doctor, can you get a job in the United States? Of course you can. Are you running a business where you could just move its headquarters to the United States or to Germany or to somewhere else? Of course, we can do that. Most of the people that would move would be the better off. Okay, see if you're following me. You don't have to agree with this. I think the people who would leave would be the better off ones. I also think they would be almost entirely Ashkenazi. That is, people of European heritage. Well, of course, the only way you're going to have an EU passport is if your ancestors are from Europe. If your ancestors are from Iraq, you're not going to have an EU passport. Let's think of another scenario, a somewhat different scenario. What if Palestinian commandos came across the border and seized a settlement? Not one of those big settlements with 20,000 people in it. Let's talk about one of those little settlements. A lot of those settlements, there are 150 or 60 of those settlements. Most of them are really small settlements. Let's imagine a settlement that has 100 people in it. They're out there somewhere in some isolated place showing that the Jewish people can control anything they want. They're true believers. And suddenly they're attacked. And a group of commandos come in and manage somehow to kill everyone in the settlement. maybe there is only 50 people in the settlement. There are some that small. So a group of commandos come in and they manage to kill everyone. Okay, 50 people, you can lose 50 people. That's not the end of the world. But you know what Mao Zedong said? He said, if you have a choice of attacking, when he was a guerrilla leader in the 30s, he sent advice to his commandos. He said, if you have a choice of attacking a group that has 200 people in it and killing 25% of them, that's what, 50 people. Or if you have a choice, the other choice is attacking a group of 20 people and killing all of them, you should attack the small group and kill all of them. Why? Because if you attack the large group and just kill 25% of them, people are going to say, other soldiers will say, if I had been in that unit, I would have been one of the survivors. Maybe they wouldn't, maybe they wouldn't, but that's the way people think. But then they say, oh my gosh, that other group, every last person was killed. The psychological shock, the trauma of realizing that a group was totally exterminated has an enormous psychological impact. So suppose a group of Palestinians came in and attacked a small Jewish settlement and killed everyone in the unit. Now, of course, we know what would happen. It'd be a suicide mission, wouldn't it? The Israeli military is very good. They would come out, and in the end, they would kill all the Palestinians. Okay, that's likely to be the outcome, but that's not the point. The point is not that the Palestinians were killed. Who cares? That's the job of the military to kill Palestinians. But what is really significant is that a whole settlement was wiped out. If you were parents living in an isolated settlement, and you had three little kids, and you read that, would you say, okay, we're going to stick it out because we're settlers and we're brave and we're tough? Or would you say, I think it's time for us to get our kids out of here? They could be striking here next. I think if this happened, there would be a very large exodus of settlers from the West Bank. You know what? If there were a river running along the Green Line, this is a bit bizarre to think about geologically, but what if there were? The Irish had this wonderful song all these years that they were thinking about someday being independent from England. They had this song. The sea, oh, the sea, the beautiful sea, long may it flow between England and me. It's a sure guarantee that some hour we'll be free. Thank God we're surrounded by water. If the Palestinians were on an island, it would become obvious that the Israelis could not hold them. But they're not on an island. They're cheek and jowl right next to the Israelis. Israelis and Palestinians right together. The spaces are really small. We talked about this on the first day when we talked about the map. The spaces are really, really small. You go from here to Ann Arbor and you've covered a big chunk of the country, east to west. You go from Amman to Jerusalem, that's a couple hours car drive, even if you go up and down hills and slow to get some water. I've done that drive a couple times. There's not much there. So what's the outcome of this? I don't know. I don't know. I used to say, 20 years ago, if you had asked me, what do I think? I would say, I'm short-term pessimistic, but long-term optimistic, because I believe there's a settlement there and I think the negotiators were getting very close to it around 2000. If you ask me today, what's my future? What is my my assessment? I would say I am short-term pessimistic and long-term really, really pessimistic. The Israelis have just announced that as soon as they form a coalition government, Gantz and Netanyahu, it's Netanyahu and Gantz, they're going to annex much of the West Bank. What does that mean, they're going to annex it? That means they're going to pass a law. You know what? This is what the white South Africans did during apartheid times. They would pass a law and they would say, Zululand is no longer a part of South Africa. It's now an independent country and we recognize it. And they have a president that we put in power. There's an army, which we're funding. They have programs, which we're financing. And we've now reduced the black population of South Africa by several million. And by the way, Botswana is now independent. We just passed a law. We declared Botswana independent. And by the way, the Xhosa, the Xhosa are now independent in Transkei. We just passed a law. Okay, what was changing? And by the way, this group of black people who are right in the middle, they called them black spots, a group of black people living right in the middle of white South Africa, we just passed a law and declaring them to be a part of Zululand, so they're no longer in white South Africa. And you say, wait a minute, they're still there. They were there yesterday, they're today. Yeah, but we passed a law. They were delusional. Looking back, this is the black swan. Looking back, you can see that they were delusional. They kept doing all these things, delivering these speeches. Their advocates would come around to the United States. They would write stories, op-ed pieces in the American press, in which some American would say that the South African government has suddenly recovered its senses and recognizes that they cannot keep black people under their control, and they're now giving them their independence, and this is going to be wonderful, it's going to solve the problems. Come on, it didn't solve one single problem. Nothing changed, except the fact that the white parliament passed a law declaring Zululand to be independent, declaring Transkei to be independent, declaring Botswana to be independent. It was a joke. It was nothing. The Israelis are going to pass a law annexing the West Bank. The Israelis passed a law annexing Syria's Golan province. President Trump praised them and said, this is only natural. It has to be done. It's obvious. This is, they're going to hold forever. Why not annex it? So they immediately created a town called Trump something or the other in the Golan as appreciation. Now they're going to annex the West Bank. They've already annexed East Jerusalem. What's different? I don't know. I don't think anything's different. I'll tell you what I do think. Somewhere out there, there's a black swan. And we're not paying any attention because we're looking at all these white swans. Am I leaving you discouraged? You know what I want you to do is to write a two-page reaction to this. Reaction, not a summary. Reaction. What do you think about this? Does this make sense to you? Or doesn't it? Okay. Thanks a lot. 49 minutes. Okay, very good. Bye-bye.